Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And there are so many questions about the medical profession that have been coming around in general, you know, especially with the release of Michael Moore's new film, which I was fortunate to see yesterday. There are so many questions that are appearing about the way that our medical system has evolved and the way that our, especially our psychiatric system has evolved. How we treat children, how we treat people using all of these different medications and iatrogenesis. Yes, you do want to know what iatrogenesis is, don't you? Isn't it? Iatrogenesis sounds like the birth of. It is the birth of. We're going to be talking about that today. We're going to be talking about somatization disorders. We're going to be talking with two great people here. Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, psychiatrist, who you've heard on a year with us many times. He's our in-house shrink. He is somebody who helps people with psychiatric disturbances and is very slow to recommend medication and does minimal medication recommendations, but does not believe that it's the only answer. And Dr. Alan Lanz, L-A-N-S, from a psychiatrist, hospital special surgery, and private practice. Very interesting to have two psychiatrists in the room, both who believe that the world tends to be over-medicated. So we're going to speak with them. Kent, welcome to the program. Alan, welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, there we are. Hi there. Say, I just missed that. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
As all right, so Kent, why don't you start it rolling? What do you think?
Well, I think that all of the movie with Michael Moore, that there's a lot of feeling out there that trends in our society are such that we're really getting to a point where people are looking for a quick answer with some of the life difficulties that people have. So that, you know, with managed care companies getting involved with decreasing the amount of care that people get and the amount of time that people can spend with their doctors, along with what's also evident in that movie is the very powerful effect that pharmaceutical companies have about pushing the idea that there are perhaps quick and easy answers for what I think are very complicated emotional or physical problems. And I think those two things are where we need to look at everyone in the audience's own personal responsibility to counter those sort of trends, you know, that that there are now, you know, quick and easy answers to, again, very complicated problems, emotional problems and medical problems.
It's very natural to expect quick and easy solutions. I mean, you know, I mean, when you were 200 years ago, you know, if you get cut by something in the woods, you put on that oak salve, and that would be a quick and easy solution. What's wrong with quick and easy solutions? I mean, quick and easy solutions are, they're nice. You know, you get an upset stomach, you take a little antacid of some kind. Quick and easy.
Yeah, I think that sometimes it really gets to not really getting at the heart of what's causing the problem. So one of the things about just putting a medication or a quick medication to certainly an emotional or psychiatric problem, it may just kind of hide the symptoms to some degree, but I don't think it's really getting at curing or solving the problem. And that's one of the dangers, I think, with over-medicating. I think it's one of the dangers about doctors in the medical profession as well. They're not really trying to get to a curative place about what's causing the discomfort. It's just a sort of Band-Aid. And obviously, over the last few weeks, there were many articles in the New York Times about lots of things about children and adolescents being on medications when there's behavioral problems and emotional problems that are going on, which again may quick and easy sort of have children behave better, but I'm not sure it's really getting at the sort of problems that may be going on in the child's life or the parent's life or the family life that will really get to the heart of what's going on.
I would agree, and I think that the relationship between a patient and a doctor is just based on that word. It is a relationship. And in order to have any kind of treatment be effective, there has to be a relationship between the two. what we have now very often, not always, but very often, is treatment without understanding, as well as expectations for cure without really understanding what's being treated. So I think the doctor-patient relationship, which has been severely compromised in our current environment, needs to be restored, because all treatments are culturally bound as well. And in our society, in most societies, the healer, or the one who is the vector of healing, has to have a relationship with the person who's being treated.
And that, what's happened to those relationships? I mean, people are so skeptical about going to a physician in general nowadays, because they know, you know the physician's going to sell you the latest drug that he's got a trial for, or he's going to, you know, you can't trust your physicians anymore, can you?
Well, he's under a great deal of pressure to see many patients and to come up with a treatment that's according to evidence-based medicine, which is a kind of idea that is anything but evidence-based. It is the idea that medicine can be reduced to a formula, and you can just follow one thing from one algorithm to another and find out the answer. But it doesn't really involve spending time and listening. It's listening without hearing is what's happening. And I think that that's been taken out of the relationship, and it's very hard to restore it, because there's a demand to see that many more patients in that short a period of time.
It's kind of amazing. Everybody, I'm sure, in the audience has had the experience of talking to a physician and watching his eyes kind of wax over. You know, like he's not really hearing a thing. He already knows what he's going to prescribe and what's coming in your direction. My guests are Drs. Alan Lanz and Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We are talking about medicine and the state of medicine. And I think you say something really interesting there, Alan. You say, let's have pity on the physicians, because even if the physicians believe that they must have that home in Malibu, and that's the reason that they have to see 100 patients in a row and do quick surgeries, even if that's their motivation, we have to realize we have created this. This is what we've created. This is what we have brought into this world. We brought into this world physicians who believe that they have to accumulate as much wealth as possible, and with dreams of getting out early, you know, and to try to, they don't even care about fame anymore, you know. Nowadays, well, it's just about the acquisition.
Most physicians that I know are really exhausted. The demands on them have been tremendous, not only on the part of patients, but on the part of regulations, insurance companies, the need for all kinds of forms to be filled out, HIPAA regulations, insurance forms. They really are exhausted. And I think maybe the house in Malibu applies to some, but I really think physicians all, obviously not every all, but all pretty much, are motivated by the idea that they're doing some good for people. Because I don't think any of us could really go to work if we didn't really feel that what we were doing had some real value in terms of helping people. And the difficulty comes because we have to do that very often in very quick ways, without measured thinking, without careful planning, but just jumping ahead and treating before we really fully know what we're treating or who we are treating.
It's kind of interesting that, you know, you talk about the intention of the physician and the ones that you hang out with. I wonder if we have to break it into two categories. You know, do we have to do the in-network providers and the out-of-network providers? You know, the non-network providers versus the in-network providers. I see a lot of in-network providers. They are thoroughly exhausted. Usually, there may be many of them from Pakistan or some other country come in. They're doing work. They're doing the work of angels. I mean, they are working all day, all night. They come to your house. They're almost like the French and the English doctors, physicians that you see. True physicians, dedicated to the work. That's one group in network. And then you have the other group, the group who says, and I received a note from a physician recently who informed me that my physician is stepping out of network and will no longer be in network, and he's just going to do private pay-as-you-go stuff. And you got the physicians who are doing it the other way, and they're saying one of two things. Either I don't want the regulations, I don't want to do all the paperwork, but they're also saying I can't make enough money that way. So I think, is there two categories of physicians here? I mean, you.
I think the people that opt out of the insurance plans or decide not to do that any longer, they are the ones that maybe can divide it in sections. But most of those people that I know who have done that and people that I read about who have done that do it because they really want to spend more time with their patients. They're willing to see fewer patients, maybe reduce their income as a result of that, but really want to spend time listening and hearing what their patients have to say. They really enjoy practicing medicine. Of course, there are always going to be exceptions to that of people who see this as a way to a golden road to that house in Malibu, maybe. But I think, by and large, the bulk of physicians fit into the first category.
What, you used to be a general physician?
Yes, I was.
And then you became a lieutenant? No. You were a general physician, and then you became a psychiatrist.
Yes.
What made you make the switch, Alan?
Well, there were a number of reasons, but the primary reason was that you could no longer really spend time with people in practice in the way that I had practiced in the past. When I started in general practice, we made house calls, we delivered babies, we did some surgery, we did everything there was to do. You really got to know families. But as things began to change and insurance companies became more and more part of life, it was extremely difficult to maintain that same relationship with patients. And I wanted to do what I did best, I thought, with patients, which is to listen to them, talk to them, and hear what they had to say, and try to be helpful.
What do you believe that listening and talking is important? Well, here's what I'm going to get to. I know about your feeling about people's having physical symptoms and how physical symptoms relate to their ability to have a relationship with the practitioner, the psychiatrist, the therapist, and I know, Kent, you were talking about this also. Let's talk about how people somatize illness and what that all means.
Well, I think it's a hard concept for people to understand that there may be a process inside people psychologically or in our relationships to have a way of perhaps amplifying or having certain symptoms in our body perhaps be more pressing or more problematic than they need to be for very complicated psychological and social reasons. So it's a very hard idea for, I think, many, many people to hear, because it doesn't make any sense, you know, that why would I want to have more pain, or why would I want to have more discomfort? So it's not anything that we're saying goes on consciously, that people are malingering or they're lying or making up their symptoms for some conscious purpose.
Well, but I think we first have to define. You're assuming people know what we're talking about. Okay, let's start off when we talk about a somatized disorder. Somaticized disorder, what does that mean?
It means that it's a symptom or a complaint of a dysfunction or a complaint of pain or a complaint of dizziness that when the doctor thoroughly examines the person, there really comes out to be no really objective evidence on physical exam or laboratory work or the like, that there's really no known process, medical process, that could explain these symptoms. Now, I've seen studies...
Now, wait, is that... Is that all somatized disorders? Why am I having a hard time?
Somatization disorders.
Somatization. But in all somatization disorders, are they all false?
No, the symptoms are very real.
You're saying, I think what you're saying, Kent, is the symptoms are not there.
The fact that there's no evidence of other known medical processes which could explain those symptoms. So the symptoms are real.
Okay.
The person has real symptoms, but generally a doctor will spend a lot of time...
So it's not in their imagination. They have real pain. They feel real pain, real illness.
Or real dizziness, or
real
stomach upset.
So a good example of this would be a person under emotional stress who is under emotional stress and they suddenly get an ulcer.
Right.
That's a case of... Right?
Good example. Very good example.
Okay,
yes.
And what you're going to do as a psychiatrist now, you're being given people who have these physical pains and they have these physical disorders, and what most physicians would do is they would treat the pain. If you have that pain, let me give you a little painkiller. right? If you have a pain, if you have a heartbeat that's missing, we'll give you a little diltiazem or something.
Well, I wanna say that again. When stress causes an ulcer, and stress causes hives, let's say on the skin, then that's an example of, you know, something emotional going on that causes a documented sort of medical problem. I'm extending it a little further to say that evidence would suggest that about 40% of people under 50 years old who go to their doctor, there is actually no physical evidence on examination or laboratory or x-ray that there's anything wrong, even though the person is having subjective complaints. So it's even a step beyond saying stress or anxiety and emotions are causing hives or ulcers, because on physical exam you would actually see those kinds of manifestations. It's actually that studies would show that there are actually no evidence of anything wrong, and yet the person is having a great deal of complaints. I brought in today, for example, one on dizziness, that there was a study showing that people who go to doctors with complaints of dizziness, that well over 40 to 50% of the people on examination, there's nothing wrong with their ears, there's nothing wrong with their nervous system. There's all sorts of complicated things that Alan and I have learned that can cause dizziness, like tumors and seizures and the like. Well, it gets ruled out in the vast majority of people. And the study showed that the dizziness was a manifestation of anxiety. If you treated the anxiety, the dizziness would get better.
To put it in the way it really works, I think, is what happens. Let's sort of imagine a patient for a moment who's got abdominal pain and, let's say, intermittent diarrhea. And they go to see their physician, and the physician examines them and doesn't really find anything, does a group of blood tests and doesn't find anything on the blood tests, and now says, well, I don't see a cause for this, but in a sense of being complete, now we ought to send you to a gastroenterologist. A gastroenterologist enters the picture and does barium enemas, other kind of x-ray examinations, still doesn't find anything, and says, well, now we have to do a colonoscopy. Do a colonoscopy, and they find, well, maybe there's some irritation, some irritable bowel, and they send them back to the physician. What has been created is a reinforcement of symptomatology, that there is a real issue going on that has not yet been diagnosed, but we're going to find it. It sets a mindset of saying that there is an underlying disease that's being misinterpreted, misunderstood. And this goes on and on. The patient keeps coming back. Now, each physician in the process, again, this physician who's under pressure to get something done, his response is to send it to the next specialist. What's happened in our system is that really there are no more pilots in the plane. So everybody has a little piece that they do and sends someone else on. And when it comes to somatization disorders, physical expressions of emotional states, no one is willing to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is not really coming from some physical state, but you need some evaluation of what's going on with you emotionally.
And when you, as a psychiatrist, it's most easy for you to see it, or most psychiatrists I know would just recommend a medication at that point.
I don't know. It may be so. I mean, again, you have psychiatrists who are in the world of managed care also, who have to see a patient in 15 minutes and send someone on, so they listen to the symptoms and write a prescription. So they become part of the process rather than the end point who takes control of the situation. But you have to have a patient who has to understand, is willing to undergo the process, and you have to have a psychiatrist who's willing to sit and listen. But it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. It could be any physician along the way.
And even I would say that things like that patient we just described, there's, again, a lot of, you know, having this person see all these specialists as they're trying to find out some kind of disorder that's going on in the bowel. Not only would a psychiatrist come in to say that there are emotional things going on, I would argue that I see patients all the time that the medical doctor is really not asking about what would be you know, things that would just jump out at you, which is like, how are you eating and your diet? So that I find most doctors aren't even pursuing things that are more like preventive kind of things, or for lack of better words, just commonsensical things of like, oh, you have diarrhea or whatever, but you're eating Mexican food at 10:30 at night with two margaritas, or just things like that. The doctors are not incentivized to do those kinds of questionings to either see that it's something psychological, or I would even argue could be something that would be addressed with something like nutrition and diet or something like that.
What happened? What happened to our minds? We had this, you know, and I'm talking to you two as physicians, but I'm imagining most physicians that I know, and I know you two are outstanding in the field. I know that you stand aside from, I know neither of you have the house in Malibu, you know, and you're not working for, oh, you do have a house in Malibu.
I have several houses in Malibu.
You have several houses in Malibu.
But my wife works.
So she's a lawyer.
So the idea here is that you have something happened to us. Something happened that made us, and I'm again, you know, I'm always turning back to us being the creators. We turned our physicians into something other than what they were. We sued them. We challenged them. We told them you're going to be accountable, which they should be, but we overdid it. We had people who were saying, oh, there's a little glitch here. Let's sue everybody. They found that, so they raised the insurance thing. They took the physicians and they put them under a great stress to keep their practice going. And we're all a part of it. We are, every one of us are a part of creating what is there now in this medical profession in the United States. We have all done it. Every expectation we have, every time we go to a physician and we say to a physician, find out what's wrong with me, and he says to you, I'll give you this prescription, and we take that prescription without questioning what it is, how does it work, you know, not going to the internet where we have all our information available and finding out everything about this medication that we might take. We've turned it over. We hope that there's somebody, and the word is, I hope there's a doctor I could trust. But that's the problem. The problem is you don't, it's yourself you need to trust.
I think one of the things, obviously Alan and I have a tradition as a medical training also to provide that easy answer, right? To say, like, again, I always use going to a dentist. You know, it's not too complicated. When I go to the dentist, I have a toothache, they find a cavity, and magically I feel better. You know, it's just that there's so few things I find medically that's the case under 50 years old, that in fact the vast majority of things, the prescription or the surgery is not going to be the answer. And so, but that's where we doctors come from. But as you're saying, the patient also needs to be educated about that. But I'm also saying that one of the things that Alan and I think tell people are things they don't really want to hear. And I think patients want to be responsible for that. That if you go to a doctor and he walks out with a diagnosis and a prescription, you're off the hook. What if, you know, when I bring up how your eating patterns are affecting your stomach, you don't like that, you know, like I'm challenging you in a way and saying, you know, you have some responsibility for your medical problem, but you may be really wedded to have your burritos at 10:30 at night, you know, and so you may not be want to hear some of the advice. Now, Alan and I, who deal with, Alan's an expert in chronic pain and back pain more than myself. I mean, the number of times we get a patient where we're bringing up things like exercise and stretching, which the evidence is so powerful how important it is. And the patient will both say, my doctor, my surgeon, never brought this up, that I should be doing that, which just blows my mind because these are the alleged experts in back pain. But let's be clear, I think the patients themselves don't want to hear that kind of information because that means I'm responsible for my pain. You know,
well,
I'm partially responsible.
And again, you know, we've created this so that patients can want the simple answer. You see, we've all fed this system. We fed the system where they don't come to you and say, what is the best thing I could do for myself? Because you're going to say, well, of course, we're talking with Dr. Ken Robichaud and Dr. Alan Lance. Alan, you are at the Hospital for Special Surgery. You deal with orthopedic pain all the time. You deal with people coming in and they have either pain or they have depression related to pain. We're going to talk, by the way, after our break. I want to get your perception of pain. We take a break at 1:30. I want to get your perception of pain, and we're going to talk specifically about pain. But when people come to you and you look at them and you want to ask the tough questions, you know if a movie star comes to you, you know, and the movie star walks in and you suddenly look at this movie star, they don't want to hear answers like, well, you've got to exercise and you've got to do this. They want your pill. I've had enough movie stars come my way, and they come in and for therapy, and I say, well, we got to dig in and do the work. No, how can I get my husband to not do this anymore? You know, how do I deal with them? How do I do that? If you schmooze them, if you take them, oh, you're wonderful, you're great, I feel so, you're fabulous, and you go in that door, you may get them to stick around, but they'll never do the work. But how do you do it? How do you get somebody motivated beyond their need for simple solution? How do you do it? How do you generate that, inspire that in people?
You inspire it by creating a relationship between you and the patient.
All right.
And that just takes time. It takes time to develop trust. It doesn't happen immediately. But the patient has to believe you, and you have to believe the person. And you can't do that usually in one fleet visit. You have to establish some kind of contact with that person. I don't mean personal contact.
Yeah, I know what you
mean.
But
understanding that you're there to help. You're there to understand. And you're there to listen. I don't know any other way that it can really happen.
Now, in your private practice, you, of course, can do that.
Yes.
But at the hospital for special surgery, you can't do that. They're in and out.
No. I'm going to give you the false impression. I see those patients because they're referred to me, or I see them starting in the hospital, but it's a beginning of developing a relationship so that they can have some understanding of what we think is going on with them, and even to refer them out if they come from far, because many of the patients at that hospital come from great distances, where they can get help along the same line, but start them on the path. And the willingness to develop that relationship is what makes it work.
Ken?
Yeah, I think that it's... Again, it's part of a physician wanting to do that to help a patient suffering. I think doctors don't have enough information. I think in medical school training today, there is precious little information that is taught to doctors about the complicated evidence about the brain and how the mind affects the body. So there's a lack of training in that regard, as well as, you know, I think we're skirting around something very obvious here, which is if I'm a GI doctor or a back doctor and I'm intuiting that there's anxiety or depression, I'm referring this patient out, right? And that patient's not going to come to me and pay me anymore. So let's be clear, doctors' own mercenary monetary incentive to tell the patient that they really have some sort of bowel or back or dizziness problem. If they make a referral to a physical therapist, to a dietitian or a psychologist or to the DeMille Center, I'm losing the patient. Why would they do that? And so, sadly, in our American system, there's no incentive for that. From my reading of the Michael Moore movie, there seems to be, at least in other countries, that incentive would be, let's get the patient well, and if it means they need to leave my practice or my specialty, so be it. It's for the patient's good. Certainly, Alan and I are in a position when there's a medical problem that's being disguised as a psychiatric, like thyroid. My job as a psychiatrist is to say, oh, it's not anxiety, it's thyroid. You need to go to my friend, an endocrinologist, for you to be well. And similarly, a lot of medical doctors need to say, you know what? I think this is anxiety. I think this pain is amplified by depression. You should go to the DeMille Center. You should see Alan Lanz. They can help you.
Well, you know, enough of this place. But truthfully, the talking cure, you know, truthfully, the fact that there is something that happens when you speak to people and you learn about them, we're going to get back to that as soon as we take our break. This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then continuing on our discussion. Thank you. And we're back with you. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you some wonderful music. That was J.J. Johnson and Kay Winding. And just to tune you a little backwards, we'll play this for Alan Lanz, because I'm sure he's familiar with Django by the Modern Jazz Quartet, huh? Alan, I saw you when you knew J&K. I said, man knows his music. And we're here because we're talking about the state of the medical world, or the state of the people world, or the state of the world. You know, everybody wonders what effect a Michael Moore movie is going to have on people and on society. And most of Wall Street believes, oh, nothing, no effect, nothing whatsoever. It's not going to change anything. But I saw the question being asked on four different channels immediately. As soon as the film was released, they were saying, and what about this? So I think there's some dramatic changes coming. And what I'm applauding here are two men who have been part of the change because they never gave in to being just the simple solution pain prescribing doctors. These are people who believe that the human mind has a terrific relationship, a great relationship to all forms of pain, including psychological pain like depression or physical pain, and that the way to approach it is to try to get to the bottom of it by talking about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But what's a poor soul to do? Suffering in pain and really not having exhausted what they can do medically, but still having no relief of their symptoms or perhaps even worsening of their symptoms, having taken a number of medications that have affected them, the side effects finally getting to them. What is a person to do under those circumstances? When you say, well, let's talk about it, it seems like a weak tool to use against this mountain, this sea, this tsunami of medications, treatments, surgeries.
Can we include the biggies in here? Let's talk about cancer. Let's talk about your cancer. Let's talk about your tumor.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's daring of you to say it, but I say yes, too.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, I've seen enough courageous people come by our place here and say, I know I have cancer, I know I'm going through all this stuff, but I know there is something contributing to it that has to do with my emotional state of being, and I want to make sure that whatever it is I'm going through, the rest of me, that my psychological mindset is cleared.
Well, certainly what we know is that the immune system, the endocrine system, all those systems that have to do with pain or medical disorder of any origin, that when depression, which is often a feeling of hopeless and helpless, starts entering in, and that's where Alan and I run into people all the time, whatever the origin of the pain, whether it's very psychological in origin or it's cancer, it doesn't make a difference. Once they're in a place where the pain is now causing feelings of worry about what's going to happen, is my pain going to get worse? Am I ever going to get better? Depression, hopelessness, nothing seems to help. Nothing seems to be able to help my pain syndrome. And that's where talk therapy can help a lot of people, and evidence after evidence would show that the brain powerfully will affect the immune, the endocrine, decrease cortisol and stress, and all the things we know that are bad of pain of and medical problems of all origins.
Yes, I would say absolutely so. That's not to imply that talk therapy is going to cure cancer or tuberculosis. It's not going to do that. But it certainly can make life far more meaningful for the sufferer. And just to talk about...
Well, I'll take that a step further. I don't think it would cure, but if somebody has a recurrent condition, there might be stressors somewhere hidden around in the body where it might cause a better remission. I've seen that. I've seen people who have had really serious, serious conditions. It's not cured, but it's not activated anymore. You know what I mean?
Correct. And I think that that's when a psychiatrist, we work with other physicians for the whole treatment of the patient.
Oh, my God. Physicians so, working together?
Yeah, yes.
No.
Sorry about that, but it does
Whoever
happen.
Heard of such a thing?
We try not
you
to let people know.
You mean two of you
know.
Talking to each other? Yeah. I went to a physician one day, and he said, did you have your blood test? I said, I thought he sent them over. He said, oh, no, I don't deal with that lab because they don't no longer contribute and collaborate. I mean, doctors don't talk to each other unless they refer to each other and they get some kind of a commission from it.
Well, this doc does it every day.
You talk to other doctors
because
I
my
patients. Matter with you.
Well, I'm sorry. I hate to admit this publicly, but talking to doctors is what I do every day.
Yeah.
Because you can't treat people alone. You have to be part of a team. Very often you have to assemble a team yourself and who the members ought to be with the aid of the patient. But that team can be very helpful, and particularly in conditions you're talking about.
Alan, when you do that and you call up a physician, do you ever find that they are sometimes surprised? I mean, because many of them will send you the very patients that you're treating, but do you ever find that they're surprised that there is somebody who wants to take enough effort to put in some extra time that you're not going to get paid for to try to talk about this? Do you ever find that they're almost like in shock?
No, I don't find it that way at all. I find them actually the people that I work with mostly are very happy to have this resource and are quite willing to be part of a collaborative effort. So there's no real surprise in it. It's more like, gee, this is nice. You know, I'm glad we have it. But they accept it and they expect it. So it's become part of the routine. And I think psychiatrists, and I think Kent would agree with me, is that psychiatrists who work in this field particularly with somatizations, people who have physical symptoms, is that you need the input of other physicians to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I think that again, what I said about medical training, I would argue that right now at the best universities in New York, that medical students are not getting any, maybe in a little bit within psychiatry, but not even a lot in psychiatry. There's not a lot of psychiatrists like Alan and myself interested in pain. That's been taken over by the anesthesiology world, you know, who like to anesthetize, the opposite of talk therapy. They like to schlag people as a rule. So,
well, haven't pain doctors who are the psychiatrists who deal with pain, haven't they become an anesthesiologist in effect? How can I make you numb? In effect, isn't every Percodan and oxycodone recommendation kind of a commitment to let me help
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Again, I think it really leads to the feeling that we get, Alan and myself, when we get somebody who's in chronic pain, often back or other, and they're on narcotics, and again, like the New York Times article 2 weekends ago in the magazine section, where people are really hopeless. They're really at a place where no surgery, no pill, no curative effect is going to happen, and they're not at a place where much people have told them about exercise or stretching or physical therapy or all those active processes are going on, that the only thing that's going to help my chronic pain syndrome are these chronic narcotics. And that's where they walk to us. And the idea that talk therapy and being active and exercising and stretching and the things like that will offer as much hope and as that narcotic is very hard for patients to hear.
The idea that less is more is a difficult idea to get across. And it requires a kind of faith, a kind of understanding, a kind of agreeing to go with that process. And to experience that reducing the need for medication can, in fact, be beneficial. And if you say to someone, look, if you have the same amount of pain that you have now, but take half the amount of medication you take, are you that much better off? And people very often will understand that and accept it and come to accept it and really do it.
Well, wait, let me hear that again. If you have the same amount of pain and you could take half the medication that you take, so for example, let's say a person has a migraine pain and they take Demerol, and you say to them, look, if you could take instead of 10 milligrams of Demerol, you take 5 milligrams of Demerol. And you're not saying, are you that much better off? Are you saying, is there that much of a difference? What are you saying at that
point?
Well,
I'm saying, well, that's the beginning. The beginning is saying, look, just trust this far. If you take, I wasn't talking about migraine in particular. I'm talking about a chronic situation where you're suffering daily pain. If you can reduce your need for medication by a degree, instead of having the idea that I need more medication to relieve my pain, suppose we allowed you to take less, and suppose your brain began to adjust to the idea that less medication will do the same job, maybe that's the way you can go.
Well, that's an interesting concept because, you know, if we think about it, one of the things we know about addiction and about using painkillers is that over time the brain habituates to a certain level of medication, and then it commands to get the same relief, a change. What we never thought of is it may just as well command a change for less as well as a change for more. We never think, well, you know, it's clear that the old key to the lock is not working anymore, but maybe we need a smaller key, not a bigger key. No one ever thinks about that. That the reason that it doesn't work anymore is not because you need double the amount, but you may need half the amount. Is that your concept?
Yes, pretty
much.
That's brilliant.
Alan, it's not said. It's good.
And I think that it takes, you know, people have to understand it and try to work with it. And, you know, very often in people who are taking chronic narcotics for real pain, cannot distinguish between what is pain and what are withdrawal symptoms. And very often in fine, upstanding, law-abiding people who were never substance abusers, who are not addicts, who may be addicted but are not addicts, find that what happens when the level of narcotics go down in their bloodstream, they begin to get what are the equivalents of withdrawal symptoms, which can be pain.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure, and that would be a natural response. Withdrawal is the chemical calling for itself back in the body.
Correct.
And saying, yes. Look, we're going to let you know, if you stop taking a narcotic, you're going to be feeling your own body without endorphins, because here we were substituting the endorphins for you. And for a little while, the pain, that's where they need the relationship with you. In fact, yours is going to be a preparation when you tell them, we're going to have you take, instead of twice as much, we're going to take you half as much. But keep in mind, along with this, you're going to feel an increase in pain, which is going to be a symptom of the cure. See, now with that, like we work with, here we work with sometimes people come in who are depressed. And when we work with them, we have a couple of dynamic ways of working with depression. We warn them that as a result of this, they're going to feel anxious at the beginning. That if you take off the mask of depression, you may feel jumpy and irritable, which to depressed people is the worst feeling in the world. And then we encourage them with information. We say to our patients, and that's the beginning of the cure. So when you feel it, look at it, and even though you're going to feel jumpy, know this is the sign you're getting better. Now, if physicians would do that and lead people that way, I think people would perceive it differently.
Yes, I agree. And I think that even telling people that having those kind of feelings after being depressed, sometimes it's good to feel a little jumpy.
Yeah.
You're alive.
Great. It's great. You're alive. Exactly.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the psychiatric field as well should be stepping back when we have patients that walk in our doors who are on three different meds, a high dose of an antidepressant, a mood stabilizer, and an antipsychotic, let's say, which I see all the time, and they're not doing well, to sort of what I'm saying about medical doctors, we should look in the mirror and say, well, clearly all these meds are not doing well, and ironically, maybe less is more, in a sense that I'm not sure we're tapped out biologically at this point about what we can do. So, why, you know, every time you go and get a new pill, maybe you have like a placebo or feel helped, but after a month or so, it's not working anymore. So even if you felt better when we added the antipsychotic, it's not sure that it was the antipsychotic or just the fact that you felt listened to and you had something that gave you some hope, but after a month or so, you're back to the same place. And I routinely will take people down, way down on their doses of antidepressants and mood stabilizers and antipsychotics with the idea that I think you can be on less meds and subtly you're going to have some feelings and emotions coming back, because talk about iatrogenic, meaning doctor cause symptoms. We psychiatrists really, you know, get people over-medicated that they're kind of numbed. They're like, you know, they're like zombies a little bit.
You have to deal with also, you have to deal with the fact that the general physician has gotten his hands on the SSRIs and the SSNIs, right?
SSNI.
The SSRIs and the SSNIs, and they've gotten their hands on these, and now the general physician knows enough to say, I got an answer for you, let's give you Prozac. And now the general physician will put you on Prozac at doses where they don't have the sophistication that you have. I've seen so many patients who have walked in, I'm taking Neurontin, I'm taking Prozac, and I'm taking Zyprexa. And I look at it and I say, hey, where did you get this? And they say, well, my physician, and I'm taking Ambien to go to sleep at night, and then I'm taking a little theosophin to wake me up in the morning. You know, and where did you get this thing? Well, the doctor just said, do this, because I think the physicians are starting to feel like they want control of the case or something. Why wouldn't they send that person out? Why would they do that? Why would a non-psychiatrist give psychiatric recommendations to a patient? Why?
Because I think it happens in somewhat of a different way.
Okay.
What happens is a patient goes to the doctor, and the doctor knows they can only spend a little bit of time with him, whatever that time is. At the end of the examination, the doctor's out the door, and the patient says, by the way, doctor, I've been feeling a little anxious lately. And the doctor, thinking about the next patient, says, well, okay, here's some Valium, Xanax, Ativan. Next time the patient comes back, the same thing happens. Now, you know, I'm not feeling any better. Well, how about, here's some Prozac. Can't hurt. And I think that's how it really gets established.
So you think it establishes that, and what happens to many physicians is they don't remember who you are and what your chart is and what the effect of this. They don't think about combining medications. They don't think about giving somebody, you know, and saying, watch out, don't eat grapefruits. You know, they don't think about all of that. And they don't think about that because what you're saying is they're in a hurry, and it's conservation of energy is what results that way.
And the marketing of these drugs have been very effective in speaking about their safety, that they basically do not interact very much with other medications, certainly not the other medications the general physicians would use. They're safe to use. They're easily tolerated. So I think doctors prescribe them with a good feeling about it. They're not doing anything. They're not causing any harm.
And I know we don't have enough time for it, but physicians get rewards for prescribing. Regular physicians, general physicians, will get rewards for prescribing Prozac.
I got a house in Malibu.
You got your houses. Your houses in Malibu for prescribing medications. Yeah. But they will, you know. I mean, it's surprising that they take on the psychiatric medications. But now the reward, you know, the little they get points. They get rewards plus for prescribing something that's not even in their field. It's almost like you would start prescribing, you know, things for, well, I guess you do, but things that would not be your field at all.
But it's more subtle than that, because it's not like, you know, prescribe this and here's a reward. It's more like, oh, thank you for seeing me. Have some biscotti. That's the way it works. It doesn't really, we're having this educational dinner at some fancy restaurant
in Malibu.
In Malibu,
right?
And so you come, it'll be an educational thing, and we'll serve dinner too. So I think it's not this, you know, just handing out of money to doctors. I don't think doctors would.
I've seen it the other way. Yeah. I've seen the big rewards. Oh, well, I know a guy who said, I went on his boat once, and he said, this is my Prozac boat.
Well,
he was bought with Prozac.
I'm sure you're right. But
Prozac.
But I think, as we're saying, to empower the people who are listening to us, we can blame the doctors and the drug companies, but how many people want to just take a pill. I mean, how many people just really don't want to dig in and look at your own behavior, your own emotions, your own feelings, the way you interact? So just walking out of a doctor, whether it's a psychiatrist or not, with a pill is this simple, you know, brave new world answer that lots of people themselves, it's not the government, it's not managed care, it's not the pharmaceutical company. We've met the enemy, and it is us. It is people who don't want to do the hard work to feel better.
Listen, this is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore and Dr. Alan Lanz, L-A-N-S. We're talking about, we're talking about the profession of medicine, psychiatry, and so on and so forth. And I tell you, I'm real pleased to have people around like this that we could talk to. And I'm real pleased that we have WBAI, which allows us to have this kind of a conversation. Beautiful, my friends. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. If you want a copy of today's program, you call 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. Or go to the website, thepositivemind.com.
Mucha, que crianza quita chora, que nuva quita pasa, é soda, é tristeza, é lembrança de minha infância, é fantasia daquele mesa, vejo a coisa sa.
The music.